This is 4:55 on October 12th. We are going to talk today about addressing in IPv4 and sort of the structure of addresses and how they're used to route traffic in the internet. So, as we've said before, an IP address is a 32-bit quantity, and it identifies not a host, but a particular interface on a host. So this is easier now to understand for everybody because they have laptops that have real Ethernet connections, and they have wireless interfaces, and they have different IP addresses, they have different MAC addresses and so forth. So everybody, I think, understands much more easily these days that the 32-bit, that the IP addresses correspond to an interface and not a host. This is grammatically wrong. Routers typically have multiple interfaces. Host typically has one interface. Well, no, not true anymore. Hosts. All the hosts that are in here have two. The notation that we use for IP addresses is, remember that we write the decimal value of each of the 4 bytes that make up the 32-bit address. Just got started doing that, and it kept on going. So this 32-bit address is not typically regarded as an arbitrary 32-bit value. It's made up of two pieces called the subnet address and the host address within the subnet. So what's the importance of this? Well, when all of your laptops are on the WSU wireless network, they all have the same subnet part and different host parts. Okay? So this is a way to simplify ultimately the way that routing works, right? If every host could have an arbitrary 32-bit value as its host address, then routing sort of out in the wild would be very difficult because you'd have to have routes information to get to every host. You know, this one, host N could be at one location and another host could be in China. And N plus 1 could be in China, and that would sort of make things difficult. So this idea of subnets helps to bring some order into the space. And the way that you tell the subnet part from the host part is that you ask, what other addresses can I reach without going through a router? Everything that's on the same subnet is reachable without going through a router. That's sort of the most practical definition of it. Yes?
And is this how the IP geolocating thing works? It just looks at the subnet
yes.
address?
Yes. Looks at the subnet part of the address, and databases have been created that relate those to where they live, and
yeah.
That's how you get them. What's a subnet? Alright, that's essentially it. Okay. So, you know, this is just a practical algorithm for determining what things are on the same subnet. Detach them from routers and see what you get. Okay. To talk about the subnet part of an IP address, we typically talk about a subnet mask. So this is a mask in the sense of masking that you think of at the very lowest levels of machine instructions, right? When you AND a set of bits with another value, that's masking that value. You're only seeing the bits that come from, that correspond to the one bits in the mask. And so a subnet mask works that way, but because of the structure of the way things are done, a subnet mask always is a prefix. The subnet part is always a prefix of the IP address. So a subnet mask is a contiguous set of ones. So a typical subnet mask would be something like 255.255.252.0. Okay? And that says which bits belong to the subnet part, and the remaining bits then belong to the host part of the address. And so the subnet masks get written both in this dotted decimal form and, because they're always prefixes, in this slash notation that says, well, I don't know what the decimal value is, but make it 24 bits. So slash 24 means a 24-bit subnet mask. What would this one be as a slash notation? 255.255.252.0. Twenty-two. Yes, because you see, it's three less than 255, and three is 2 bits, and you add that to the 8 bits, and you get 10 bits of host address, and therefore 22 bits of subnet address. So this is a notation you just have to become familiar with, in order to sort of be able to do practical stuff. Let's see. Okay, my wireless is on 134.121.158.6, and the mask is 240. So how many bits is that? Four, right? So that's 12 20. I think that one's slash 20. Okay, so that's a conversion you need to do, and then it's kind of messy, but you can mask this address with this address value to figure out what the host part is and what the network part is. But it's messy because this is done in, these are both done in decimal, and you really have to have them in hex to do that. So it's not the best thing in the world, the decisions that were made here. Finally, the broadcast address on a subnet is formed by taking the subnet address and making the host address be all ones. Okay, 1 bits. And that's what is happening here. Yes?
So, looking at this, I see we have the internet address around the mask, and then internet 6 address.
Uh-huh.
And I assume the mask doesn't apply to that because
no.
The slash.
No, no. The internet 6 addressing works completely differently. Okay, so all of this stuff on this line just applies to IPv version 4.
That's
completely different. Notice, for example, that the hardware address is actually embedded in the Internet 6 address, which is interesting. Okay. Onward. Okay, so there's an exercise in determining how many subnets there are. Detach each wire from its router and see how many wires you're left. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
So each of those wires is a subnet.
Each of those wires is a subnet, yeah. Even though they only connect point to point. Okay, so the partitioning of internet addresses into subnet and host part originally started out using a scheme called address classes. And there were four classes of address. There were class A address, B address, C address, and D address. Well, and then there were multicast addresses, but I'm not counting those. No, there were three classes. Yeah, there were three classes. A, B, C. A class A address, a class A subnet address, just meant that you had 8 bits for the subnet address and 24 bits for the host address. Alright? So there were certain 8-bit values that were reserved for that purpose. And big companies like IBM and Xerox and DEC and AT&T got those Class A addresses. And so you have this company, it gets a Class A address, and it has 16 million addresses to hand out within the company. It really made no sense, but that's what they did. And then a Class B address took some of the other values for the first byte and some of the values for the second byte and gave those out to companies. And so those companies had subnets that would support 64K hosts, 16 bits. And Class C addresses used up the rest of the A and B space and the C space. And so each of those addresses, each of those subnets allowed 254 hosts. You actually have to subtract 2 from all of those things because all zeros is reserved and all ones is reserved. So, excuse me. So that was the way things were up until the mid-90s. And then people observed that Class B subnets were too big. Well, all Class A subnets were too big. Nobody really had a good use for 24 million addresses. Almost all Class B subnets were too big. Nobody really had a use for 64K hosts. And almost all Class C subnets were too small. Right? Most people had, at the company level, had a need for more than 256 hosts. But some Class C addresses were way too big. Like for your home, you don't need more than a few hosts. So this whole thing about classes sort of became unworkable in the mid-90s. And people created this idea of classless inter-domain routing, where the subnet portion can be of arbitrary length. You can be assigned a block of however many bits for your sub-pieces of the internet, and we just distinguish the subnet part by the slash notation of how many bits. So, anyway, now that poses interesting problems for routing, because now we have to sort of have routing data structures that can cope with arbitrary boundaries. But it's not too bad, and we'll see how that works. So how do we get an IP address for a host? Those of you who've played with systems administration know that there are multiple ways. But has anybody not ever directly assigned an IP address for their host? That was a strange question. Not. Have you ever? What?
I've only done that once.
Once or twice? Okay. So what do? You go in and you say, you have to do a number of things, right? You have to say, I want to set the IP address to be thus and so. I want to set the net mask to be some number of bits. And I need to set the broadcast address typically. I don't know why we don't just infer that, but you know, usually you do. But this is a pain in the neck, right? Because to set an IP address, you have to know that nobody else is using it on your subnet. So, again in the mid-90s, this idea of dynamic host configuration came along. And what happens with this is that when you turn on your computer, it sends out a broadcast packet saying, all right, who's going to serve host configuration information on this network? And some machine that's already on the network replies and says, I do. And then once you know who you're talking to, you can actually ask for an IP address and be assigned one dynamically. And that's DHCP. DHCP can do a lot more than that. It also typically configures the routing information that a host needs. It can configure the host name information. What else? Sort of anything that you need to know to work on the network can be configured by this server that exists on the network. Questions about that? There's actually a description of it here. It's a four-step thing. Let's see. Where is it? This is probably the best one. So notice that the discover message is sent to the broadcast address. And it appears to come from the all zeros address, which, right, there are two broadcast addresses that can be used. There's the one that's local to the particular subnet, which is all one, the subnet value with all ones. And then there's this sort of I don't know who the heck I am or where I am broadcast address that is sent to all ones. And comes from all zeros, which is the indication that I don't know who I am yet. The server replies again with a broadcast because this guy doesn't know who he is yet. But it says to him, "You should consider this address." As a possibility, and then we ask for that, as again saying source and destination unknown, and ultimately we get assigned it, and at that point the client is able to use this assigned address as his own for a certain amount of time. Notice that the other thing that makes this work is that once you get assigned an address, you only are entitled to use it for a fixed period of time.
Regardless of whether you're actively using it or not.
regardless of whether you're actively using it or not. So you can, let's see, anybody know where that lives on Linuxy systems these days? Yeah, let's see. No, it doesn't have the lease type in there, but if you wander around on the WSU wireless network, you can actually shut your computer down into sleep state, come back later and have things like DHCP, SSH connections still working and so forth, because it's still within the lease period. You renegotiate the address, it still works, and so then the actual application still works over that period of time. Yeah.
Real quick, so the active the client in this case, the DHCP server, I'm assuming, is like a server that the ISP provides.
Yes.
Okay, so is your actual like computer talking to that, or is the router talking to that, and then parsing out little subnet addresses for each computer on the network?
So this is what's happening within a particular subnet. So if you have a router, typically what happens is that the router is running a subnet just for your house.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So it's the router that's actually handing out, that's serving the DHCP server role. Okay? The same thing is going on, however, between the router and the ISP, right? So on the WAN connection, the router is playing DHCP client to a DHCP server at the ISP. Okay?
What are the numbers after sourcing desk? There's 68
and 68. Those are the port numbers,
okay.
The standard port numbers for DHCP. Not obvious from the figure. Okay, well, then, so if we have a subnet address, then we can get a host address within that space. But how did the network get its address? Where did the 134.121.158 part of this come from? And that's a sort of business process. It's not even fully automated, usually. Each ISP has some sort of number of bits of space that it can allocate, right? It's got a prefix that's fixed, and within the remaining part, it can create new subnets within its host address part of the space. And so, when you need a block of addresses, you ask your ISP to give you some, and they carve up some piece of some chunk that they have and say, okay, now your network or subnet part is this many bits long and it's this bit pattern, and the remaining set of bits are up to you to assign to hosts. Okay? So that's one way it happens. The other way it happens is that, and this is typically what's done with the home routers, is that the network part is what's called a private subnet, which means that it's a set of addresses that are not allowed to be routed on the internet. And instead, your router will talk to your home computers using those private addresses, but it will translate them into public addresses when when talking to the outside. And that's called network address translation, and we'll talk about how that works at the end of this discussion. So that's really the two different ways. Either a private block or an assigned block. Yeah.
How do you, like, so you could take the, like, you could make your a computer in your home network act as a DHCP server.
Mm-hmm.
How does it distinguish who is the actual one? Because, I mean, anybody on the network could potentially
be a DHCP server. Right. So this is a network administration task. Network administrators can do that. You can have multiple DHCP servers, but they'd better tell the same story. Right? So there has to be some coordination between them so that they don't assign the same address to two different hosts.
So that's normal to have two
DHCP? It's not normal,
okay.
but it is done in some situations where you want to have higher reliability. But they have to coordinate.
Right.
They can't just be too independent.
What actually stops somebody from posing as a DHCP server?
On your home network, you wouldn't be very happy if you did that. Okay, it wouldn't work very well. But if you were to start a DHCP server and run it on the WSU wireless network, you would probably have people knocking on your door.
Okay, yeah.
All right.
But, I mean, so, but like, say for your home network, or whatever. Like, is there who dictates what is the authoritative? Like, what stops anybody else on the network from saying,
well, okay, so your home subnet is just confined to your home.
Right. So what if somebody else on your network,
like your roommate?
Yeah, your roommate or your brother, whatever it was like.
Well, you go beat him up, you know?
Anybody can
be. Yeah. You tell them not to do that, and they do it again, you beat them up. I don't know.
Okay, I didn't know if there was
No, unfortunately. All right. Well, so what this CIDR scheme does then is allows the ISPs to not have to talk about routes for every network, but rather to aggregate routing information about a whole bunch of networks that they've given out into one bit of routing information. So let's see how that works. So this guy, fly by night, he's actually behaving reasonably in this case. I don't know why they call it fly by night. But anyway, so he's got handed out handed out address blocks to a number of different organizations that sort of use up the space starting at 200.23.16. Okay, and so these addresses sort of go all the way up to 200.23.32.255. Right, that's one big contiguous block. Think about it. This 23 says that there are 23 bits of network address, which means 9 bits of host address, right? What did I say? 33 here? 31.255. Yeah. What did I say before? I said 33?
32.
I said 32. No, it's 31.255, all the way up to the boundary, which is at 32.0. Okay? So, since he controls all of those blocks, the ISP controls all of those blocks, he can say to the rest of the internet, I will take all the traffic to 200.23.16.0/20, and so that goes all the way up to .32-1. To .31.255. Let's put it that way. Okay, all of that is now destined for him, and so one route, one bit of routing one route is sufficient for him to tell to the internet about that. He doesn't have to advertise a separate route for each of his customers. Okay? Now, suppose that organization 2 gets mad and says, I don't like fly-by-night ISP anymore. I guess it was Organization 1 that moved. Organization 1 moves, right? It doesn't belong to fly-by-night ISP anymore. Takes its addresses with it. Now, fly-by-night ISP can still say, send me all the traffic that goes to .16, but ISPs are us says, give me the traffic beginning with 200.23.18. That's a longer address. And remember last time we talked about longest prefix matching for routing? Well, this one's longer, and so it overrides the route for this one and instead becomes an exception. Okay, so fly-by-night doesn't have to deal with the exception, but the internet certainly does.
So they can keep their address?
Sometimes. It sort of depends on the policies of the ISPs. Typically, I think, unless you have quite a lot of clout in terms of size, you would not be able to keep your addresses, but big companies can usually negotiate things so that they can keep their addresses. It's a real pain in the neck to have to change addresses, especially if you're using real routable addresses for all of your hosts, as WSU mostly does. Right, because it's actually easier now than it used to be because of DHCP. With DHCP in place, you can sort of go through a state where it doesn't work, force everybody to redo DHCP and hand out new addresses. That's not so bad. But things like servers and file servers and mail servers and other things, you typically don't want to configure with DHCP because then they rely on something else. So those are manually configured, and then you have to go through manually and change all those. Yeah, Dominic?
I'm thinking with how many IP addresses will be available from IPv6, does DHCP take a lesser role in some contexts?
In some contexts, DHCP does take a lesser role. Because, like in my laptop example here, you can get a working so-called link local IP version 6 address without any interaction at all with the server. But you still need the servers in order to get the subnet information and to get sort of routably onto the internet. So IPv6 has 128-bit addresses. So that's such a big number that I can't even pronounce it. So, okay, and where do ISPs get blocks of addresses? Well, ultimately, this organization called the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers hands them out in chunks to ISPs or to countries that then hand them out to other ISPs. Within the last 6 months or so, there were certain blocks of addresses that had actually been completely exhausted within this 32-bit address space. There were sort of sub-organizations that were handing out addresses that had no more to give, and ICON had no more to give them. So then it becomes a negotiation between people who already have addresses and ICON to say, are you really using those? Give them back if not. And we seem to be muddling through with IPv4 still, but it's getting tighter and tighter. And IPv6 is still sort of iffy about issues there. So, anyway, ICON also to a certain extent assigns domain names, but not everything's hierarchical. So something may be at the root of the hierarchy. You really don't want to pester it with most domain names issues and most dispute issues. There are sub-organizations that are delegated those responsibilities. And all right, so now we get to network address translation. Certain blocks of addresses are reserved for what is called non-routable addresses, which means that if they ever show up at a router, the router is not allowed to forward them anywhere. If traffic coming from those addresses shows up, it's not allowed to be routed, and the routers have no clue as to what to do with it as a destination address. So they're just not routable. But you can use them as the subnet part of a local area network, like in your home or here at WSU, some subnets are using non-routable addresses. When they get to the gateway for that subnet, the gateway will apply these so-called network address translation rules that say change traffic coming from, say, 10.0.0.4 to look like it's coming from me, 138.76.29.7. All right? So that's fine. Then somehow this box has to remember that traffic of a particular kind coming from that address and going outward, when it gets replies, need to be sent back to 10.0.0.4 is its address. And it need to be sent back to one of these hosts over here. Well, how does it do that? The additional information that it has that the rest of the world doesn't need is that it knows the port and destination information coming from this host, and so it builds a table at runtime of the traffic that it's seen going outward, and when it gets reply traffic, then it knows it where it needs to go. So with NAT, and this is typically what you get these days from ISPs for home use, you get one or maybe two IP addresses that are routable, and then it's up to you to use NAT on your local area network for all the computers that you have in your home. So this expands the availability of routable addresses. Okay, and Oh, and the good thing here is that if a host on the inside hasn't actually originated a connection to the outside, it's typically not reachable from the outside, which protects you from a lot of sort of nasty traffic. You often configure your NAT device to route certain kinds of incoming unknown traffic to a particular host on the network, but sort of in general, you can't reach the inside devices from outside without having started on the inside. Okay, so how does it work? The source IP address and port number are replaced by something that refers to the NAT device itself and perhaps a new port number. This is how, these port numbers are how the NAT device is going to keep track of the traffic. So when a remote device responds, it responds to this port number and the NAT's IP address, and the NAT device knows the traffic for that port number is really supposed to go to this device and port number. Okay, well, this isn't... There's kind of an address space compression here, right? Port numbers are only 64... there are only 16 bits worth of them. So you can run out. So it doesn't work for very large networks, but it works for our home networks okay. Then it remembers that information in its table, and when it comes in, then it does that. Pictorially, well, you can look at the picture later, but it just says what it said on the previous slide. I want to get to this last bullet. NAT is controversial, even though it is widely used. Notice that it violates the network layering theory. It's one of the... remember I said earlier that network layering was sort of how we always talk about it, but it isn't always how we do networking. So this is a place where layering is not how we do networking. The NAT devices are not just working at the network layer. They have to look at the transport layer in order to get the port numbers, and they have to manipulate the port numbers in the transport layer. So that's sort of a Puritan's view of why you shouldn't use NAT. But then there are practical issues as well, such as, we said that NATed devices are not generally reachable from the outside. And I said before that was a feature. Now I'm going to say it's a bug. Right? Theory of the internet really is that any device should be reachable from any other device, right? And your choice to block that ought to be a security choice that you make independent of the necessity of how you route traffic. And it's just NAT is just sort of a hack that is practical but not really very clean. And so it's controversial. People try to use this as an argument for deploying IP version 6, but instead we keep doing NAT. So NAT traversal problems, having servers in NAT networks is a problem. Again, I mentioned you could statically configure things to sort of coming in here be automatically forwarded there. That's I do that with my home server. You can dynamically configure it using a protocol called Universal Plug and Play. When the server starts up, it sort of advertises itself in such a way that the NAT router knows that it's a server. The the some of the gaming protocols do this. Oh, this is a different solution. I wanted to talk about a different variant of this NAT traversal problem. A problem that arises in voice over IP systems with NATs is that in some application layer protocols, you put the network address. So not only do I send traffic as coming from a particular IP address and saying source IP is such and so, I also put my source IP in the application layer data. Well, the NAT device has no knowledge of that. Doesn't know that there's a source IP address in the application data, and so it forwards it on out to wherever it's going. The application protocol at the other side looks it up and says, oh, I'm supposed to use 10.0.0.4 as something that I am going to communicate with, and I can't because it's IP local. So there are another whole level of hacks developed to deal with that aspect of things. SIP gateways and SIP forwarding and all kinds of things are dealing with the fact that certain protocols have IP addresses embedded in them. FTP is another protocol that doesn't work very well with NAT because the standard way of doing I didn't talk much about FTP, but the standard way of doing FTP is you make an outgoing connection and request a file, and for sending back the file, the FTP server makes a connection back to you using a different port. Well, that looks like something arriving from out of the blue to a NAT router, and so that doesn't work very well. There are ways to use FTP that don't do that, but the standard way is like so. Okay. Next time, we will talk about ICMP and a little bit about IP version 6. I wanted to report one thing. Last time we talked about fragmentation in IP version 6, and I was confused about sort of what the status of that was. I went and looked, and I found that in IP version 6, fragmentation is supported at the network layer, although its use is not recommended. Instead, clients are supposed to, or hosts are supposed to, communicate the biggest packet that can be sent to the transport layer, and the transport layer is supposed to obey it. But there are certain situations where that's not possible, so using the IP version 6 options fields, which means that they don't exist unless they're needed, you can do fragmentation at the network layer, but never by routers. Okay, only by end hosts.